Today, inside the Marseille Tower blocks, where a group of women are uniting to fight gang crime. And fact-checking the election. This is the story of a group of mums from Marseille, a city in the south of France. They live in an area called the Northern Quarters, where tower blocks perch high on the hills, overlooking the Mediterranean Sea.
There's a huge sense of community on these estates and a huge sense of family.
Ça va, Isha? Tu vas bien?
Loads of women say that they wouldn't be who they were without other women helping them on estates. People were constantly joking the time I spent there. Malika said to me she loves living on the Flamand estate. And she said, I love it because I met my neighbours here. And when I had no food, they gave me food. When I needed someone to look after my kids, they looked after my kids. She said, we're one big family.
But it's not just friendship that connects these women. They've been brought together by a violent criminal turf war, which is being fought in their neighbourhood.
Cité de la Busserie, quartier nord de Marseille, 17h hier. Deux hommes se mettent à tirer à la Kalachnikov.
A 29-year-old was recently shot dead with a Kalachnikov machine gun, the 10th criminal gang death in the area this year. The women, some of whom have lost family members, have decided that they've had enough. Inspired by Italy's anti-mafia laws, where recovered assets are given back to local communities, they have begun a fight to end the drug gang's reign in the Northern Quarters. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the Marseille mothers taking on the mafia. Angelique, tell me about meeting Malika. Who is she?
Well, Malika is a mum on one of the poorest estates in northern Marseille, the Flamand Estates.
Angelique Chrysaphis is The Guardian's Paris correspondent.
She's hugely outgoing, very, very smiley, incredibly positive about life, even though she'd be the first to say that life hasn't dealt her a particularly easy hand. She's 43, she's got four children, and she's had times in her life where she's faced debt, eviction. When I went to meet Malika, she took me up in the lift in this huge tower block to the 10th floor where she lives. And her apartment is spotless, like a show home, really. And we were sitting on the balcony under these bird cages, looking out past these other high-rise estates, like a forest of estates. And beyond that, you could see the Mediterranean Sea twinkling away. But on her landing, once you leave her front door, you see that hers is actually the only lived-in flat on that landing. Some are boarded up, some are being squatted. And that's because the French state has marked this building down for demolition as they're battling these estates that have been dominated by gun crime, drugs, and even Kalashnikovs. And we were discussing this, and then suddenly there was this great howling noise that came up from the street, this kind of aha being shouted by teenagers. And then you could sense people running down below. And this actually is something that you can hear regularly in the afternoons in broad daylight. And what it is, it's the call of the lookout kids. And these are the lookout kids who are basically working for drug gangs, who are made to sit on plastic chairs at the entrance to these estates, sometimes all day. And they're looking out not just for police, but also for rival gangs. And when this piercing cry rings out, dealers know to run for cover into maybe other flats or hiding places.
And how old are these kids who are working as lookouts?
Some of them can be as young as 9 years old. Many of them are between the age of 12 and 14, certainly under 15. What's happening is they're coming from places with extreme unemployment and estates where you could have 75% joblessness and over half the people living under the poverty line. If you're a young boy, you're 12, you're 14, then you can't afford regular meals and someone approaches you, it's very tempting to slip into this world.
With young people on the estate being pulled into this way of life, are mothers like Malika worried about their own children?
I think lots of mums, when you talk to them on the record, don't really want to speak out too much about gangs. But when you speak to them privately off the record, There's a phrase that comes up again and again, which is, I'm scared for my babies. One mother said to me, it's either prison, the operating theatre, or death. I'm not going to lie to you. Malika's got other friends who've been affected by gun crime. They might have lost their nephews, their sons, their friends in shootouts by stray bullets. She decided that something had to be done and that women had to speak out. And she has for a long time been working in a women's collective with a great character in northern Marseille, Fatima Mustafawi.
Tell me about Fatima. What's she like?
Fatima Mustafawi is a really brave, very outspoken woman. She was born in Marseille in the 1960s. Her parents came from Algeria and she lived in northern Marseille. And she was one of the first families to move into these new tower blocks that were built by the state in the 1970s. And she said, you know, when they moved in, they thought this was the most amazing luxury they'd ever seen. And she remembers telling me about her father who worked in a factory linked to an abattoir, and he took them to visit their new flat. And it was up high on this high rise and they had this beautiful carpet in there. And she said, you know, this whole group of us young kids, brothers and sisters, we lay down to have an afternoon nap on this soft carpet. And we woke up again to have our tea and we just thought this was absolutely beautiful. And of course, Fatima has now seen in the decades that have gone between then that that community she grew up in, which was mixed races, backgrounds, ethnicities, has become increasingly segregated. Public services have been cut and the state has really been seen as disappearing. And she has worked tirelessly to stop that, to bring back resources and to give people hope.
So Fatima set up this collective and it focused on trying to monetize the skills of people in the community so they could support themselves. And it was in this collective that Fatima, Malika and others began developing a strategy to tackle the problem of gangs in their area. How does it work?
It works like Italy's anti-mafia laws. Proceeds of crime, criminality, white-collar crime and drug crime, instead of just being seized by the government and put back into state funds, they would be ploughed back into local, small local projects like Fatima's to educate people. It could be a school, she talked about, a school for children with disabilities, a music club, digital training. And by that obvious act, local kids, local young people, local guys, drug gangs themselves would see that the proceeds of crime are being seized by the state and are being given back to what Fatima would say, the people. Give it back to the people, the victims of this sort of activity. We will use it for new exciting projects. And what a lesson that will be for people not to get into this type of gangland spiral.
So this group of women had this bold, ambitious idea. How did they begin to set it in motion?
Well, they sat down together. They said that they laughed, they cried, they thought about what to do, and they decided to write a petition to the government to copy the anti-mafia laws and to plough money back into these local communities that had been seized from crime. One passage which really stood out was when they said, to all the women, our mothers, our daughters, our sisters, despite all these constraints, we cradled, raised, and protected our children like wolves. Some have been torn from us under the indifferent eye of successive governments. We refuse to be infantilized and our words silenced. We claim our ability to self-organize and assume responsibility. Because the Marseille northern housing estates were already really well known in the French public imagination, seen as these no-go areas, immediately politicians and the public took note.
Oui, des mères, des sœurs qui ont souvent perdu un enfant, un frère dans des règlements de compte liés au trafic de drogue, elles ont décidé de lancer une pétition.
Because the issue of gangs and particularly the issue of housing estates is deeply political. It strikes to the hearts of a lot of what is wrong in France today.
Why is it, Angélique, that it is the women in this community who have taken on this fight?
These women are hugely brave, but they're also hugely proud of their bravery. And they said, we're scared of nothing, really. We're willing to go to the death to protect our kids because they're seeing teenagers every day on these estates who feel they've got nothing left to lose. I spoke to one mother and she didn't want to be named, and we sat down and ate together and spoke at length. And she said, I have never seen people this brave in my life. And she'd had a difficult upbringing as well herself. She said, there's no one braver than a mother who wants to protect her child.
But these women are taking on drug gangs. They're taking on criminals. Are they worried about this fight?
I think they talk about growing up in terror, but these are women who have navigated. You have to navigate just like you would navigate paramilitaries on an estate in Northern Ireland. You learn to live with it, and you know that you don't pick a fight with a gang. So you tread carefully. You learn to be respected, but also to respect others. And you don't go charging in to a confrontation. And so these women are hugely skilled at instead trying to present alternatives, trying to present positive projects, education, trying to talk to kids and get them to think of their futures.
Marseille is somewhere that I associate with tourism, where people go for beautiful holidays in the south of France. How has it become a centre for drug dealing and gang crime?
Marseille has always had a criminal history. In fact, its criminal history has been so exciting to some people that it became a real topic of films in the 1960s and 70s.
All right, let's hit them.
From the 1930s to the 1970s, there were the gang lords known as the French Connection, which were, of course, picked up in American cinema.
The French Connection.
And this was because at that stage after the war, Marseille was the centre of drug processing, one of the world centres of the processing of heroin. There were illegal drug laboratories all over the city, and they were processing heroin from the east and exporting it largely to America. So by the late 1960s, 80% of heroin in America and the United States was being trafficked from Marseille. The difference today is that Marseille is no longer a place that's processing and exporting drugs, but it has this new element, which is drugs being bought and consumed in Marseille, particularly hashish. And why has that happened? One of the key reasons is not the drugs themselves. It's because if you have this gaping hole in the economy where there's no employment, no job prospects, people leaving with very few qualifications and no hope, that hole gets filled by the only lucrative economy that's out there, which is the trade in drugs.
What has been President Macron's response to this situation?
So Marseille's northern estates have become a political fault line in how the centrist president, Emmanuel Macron, deals with France's fractured society. Now, the interesting thing about Marseille is these northern estates, it's not just an area of high-rise estates. These estates were built in the 50s, 60s, 70s for people coming over from North Africa, West Africa, all across Europe as well to work in Marseille. And they were peppered alongside tiny residential streets with small houses. And those streets are increasingly retreating behind fences, gated communities. And those areas are voting far right massively in huge numbers.
Has he visited Marseille?
He has visited the estates. In fact, he did one of his very favoured surprise visits to an unemployment office in Marseille a few months ago. And he was in his shirt sleeves, meeting people, talking outside. And someone shouted at him, "More jobs, less racism." And he stopped in his tracks. He didn't even look surprised. And he said, "Yes, I agree with you. More jobs, less racism."
So Macron is literally rolling his sleeves up and meeting people in some of these communities. But are his government doing enough to change the lives of some people who live there?
Yeah, Emmanuel Macron, and particularly his prime minister, spoke only a few weeks ago about this idea of a spiral on housing estates.
L'enjeu, c'est de casser un certain nombre de spirales.
non de les entretenir en stigmatisant.
And something which Emmanuel Macron has said is very close to his heart is education. That is where France is really falling down. France scores very highly as one of the countries in the developed world with the most unequal education system. And on estates like these ones in Marseille, you've got one in two children leaving school without qualifications. And even those who do manage to get qualifications really having no prospect of jobs. Emmanuel Macron has tried to cut class sizes in deprived areas for six-year-olds and seven-year-olds, arguing that will help. But a lot of people say it's not enough. Now, France, the country of liberté, égalité, fraternité, those values aren't present on these estates. There's an idea of you're not worth it. There's not enough public services. One example of this in the northern areas of Marseille, there's not enough swimming pools. And you might be on an estate and you're looking out over the beautiful blue Mediterranean Sea and the kids can't swim because they can't get to swimming lessons because there's not enough pools. There's not enough music lessons. You know, the funds aren't coming in. People aren't wanting to work in these schools and really investing in the area.
How likely is it, Angelique, that Malika and Fatima and the other women on their estate will get what they're asking for and win this fight?
It's a really interesting question in France because Malika and Fatima and all the other women and the women who've been grieving lost sons, they look to Italy, where the mafia is such a huge issue that it unites people. So when Italy put in place anti-mafia laws, decisions to pour criminal assets back into communities, there was a huge public support of that, where in France, a lot of it's being swept under the carpet. There's a lot less awareness of these issues. And the gangs and the drug lords in Marseille are very fluid. Gone are the days where you had these big characters in Marseille known as the Belgian, the Blonde. Now you've got shifting groups who maybe run a few estates, then they go into prison, someone else takes over and they come out. There's not particular identified gang bosses like there might be in a mafia family. And also in France, it's all been very hush-hush. There's been over about 900 million euros in the last 10 years worth of assets like houses, estates, cars have been seized by the French state from all sorts of crime. And they're very quietly auctioned off anonymously. And the money they make just goes back into state coffers without much more being said. And so this idea of anti-mafia laws where you really shout about what you're doing, you put a sign up outside an estate and say, this estate used to be run by mafia and now look, it's being run by a local collective. That idea, that bravery, that standing out, that would be a really big step in France. But the women are really pushing for it to happen.
Is there political will to make this law?
There have been politicians who want to push this in Parliament. There has been political will to try and adapt what you're doing with criminal proceeds. But it's also about how much you trust local community groups. It also would be to send a huge message to the whole country to say, look, Malika, Fatima, Naura, all the people who work with them, we trust these people so much. We know what they're doing is very good. And, you know, that's a given. Now we're going to plough back these proceeds into their projects to send a strong message. Is France ready for that? Well, many people hope so, but it's not certain.
Angelique, what has it felt like for you reporting on this story?
Actually, this was a really emotional story to report because many years ago, I lived and reported in Belfast in Northern Ireland. And when I was driving around the northern area of Marseille between the tower blocks and the smaller quiet streets, and I could see fences coming up, I could see gated communities, I could see roads being blocked off between two groups of people, it brought back this idea of divided cities. And that is very difficult to see, kind of people retreating in on themselves and putting up walls because they fear the other side and they fear the other person. And I think that is starting to worry people a lot on the housing estates as well.
Angelique, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read this story and more of Angelique's work at theguardian.com. Coming up, how The Guardian is fact-checking claims made during the election. Now, last week, the Conservative Party claimed that net migration would rise to 840,000 if Jeremy Corbyn was elected Prime Minister. Boris Johnson's party based its calculation on a vote by delegates at Labour's conference in September to maintain and extend free movement rights. It was not based on any actual policy in Labour's manifesto. And even if it was, The Guardian's Jamie Grierson explains why it's incorrect.
The 840,000 figure was based on the Conservatives presuming that the Labour government policy will be to extend freedom of movement, which currently only applies to EU nationals, to the world. So every person, every country would be able to come to the UK, work, live and so on in the same way that EU nationals can currently. That immediately rings alarm bells because they're entering into highly hypothetical territory. So we wanted to see exactly how they'd come to that calculation. The Conservative Party had provided a working out paper. So you click in through the press release and they said, here's our working out. So we clicked through that to take a look. It was about a 9-page document, and I'm the Home Affairs correspondent, so I cover migration issues. I've been doing so for a few years, and I've never seen anything quite like it. It was cherry-picking all sorts of different metrics, extrapolating figures to effectively reach the number that they wanted to reach at the end. For example, they used the growth rates for 10 European countries, including Poland and Czech Republic, Lithuania. They used the growth rates of the populations of nationals from those countries in the UK and effectively applied that growth rate to all countries across the world for the next 10 years, discounting all the reasons why people migrate, you know, geopolitical reasons, economic reasons. If you look at some of those countries, some of the people who moved here are now moving back because their home country's economies have improved, the British pound is weakened, uncertainty because of Brexit. So there's all sorts of reasons why people might come to a country and go again. And they've just applied this blanket growth rate to all nations across the world, also based on this presumption that this will be the Labour policy. The Labour Party was finalising its policy over the weekend. So on Saturday, they were holding what's called a Clause 5 meeting, and that's only held once an election's called, and that is the meeting in which they determine what their policy will be. At best, the Conservative Party calculations are manipulative, very selective, and have been designed to deliver a headline figure and prey on some of the fears or scepticism that people have around immigration. This is why fact-checking is really important. We're doing it cross-party. We're looking at things Labour have said, the Lib Dems have said, the Tory party have said, and beyond as the campaign rolls out. We're trying to speak to experts. We're speaking to academics. We're speaking to think tanks. We're trying to go back to the parties themselves to try and elaborate and flesh out some of the claims and proposals they're making. It's a really important part of election coverage, especially in the climate that we're in at the moment, where fake news and disinformation is so prominent in our discourse.
That was Jamie Grierson. Thank you to him and Angelique Chrysippis. Today's episode was produced by Nicola Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.